She said if something happened to her, we should check under the floorboard. Jarmeca Whitehead, known as Nikki, was a single mother fighting for control, safety, and sanity in a house where love and violence lived on the same staircase. In January 2010, she was found stabbed to death in her bathtub. Her twin daughters confessed. Case closed. Or so we were told. But what if the confession was scripted? What if the murder wasn't rage, but design? What if the real killer never touched the knife? From sealed court files, hidden cameras, and offshore accounts, comes a story buried in bureaucracy and raised by shadow puppeteers. I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to finish the story Nikki started. And if I disappear, play this episode again. This is Shadows of Justice. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. You don't forget the kind of email that changes your pulse. It came at 4:27 a.m., the kind of hour where only truth or trauma wakes you. The subject line was stark. Unveiled. Hidden killers in Conyers. The sender was blocked. The body of the email only said this. Start with the Whitehead girls. Dig into Nikki's accounts. They were never just kids. They were made. Not born. Follow the red tape. I stared at the screen, bleary-eyed, unsettled. Normally, I'd trash something that vague. A half dozen emails like that land in my inbox every month. True crime fans convinced their neighbor's dog is a serial killer or some prisoner writing poetry about conspiracies. But something about this one felt different. Calculated. And the name Whitehead rang a bell. Two sisters. A mother dead. The bathtub. That case. I remember sitting up, typing their names into the database I keep like a sacred text of chilling accounts. And there it was. Jarmeca Nikki Whitehead. Found dead in her bathroom January 13, 2010. Cause of death. Blunt force trauma, multiple stab wounds. Accused. Jasmia and Tasmia Whitehead. Her 16-year-old twin daughters. Convicted in 2014. Each sentenced to 30 years. Case closed. Allegedly. But the words, start with the accounts, scratched at something deeper. A whisper that this wasn't just a murder tale, it was something layered. A crime narrative wrapped in financial corruption, family court bureaucracy, and whatever it meant to be raised in the shadows of justice. That was the beginning of my descent. Conyers, Georgia, isn't the kind of town you picture when you think of blood in a bathtub. Small, slow-moving, Bible-heavy. A place where the sheriff waves to old ladies and porch swings outnumber traffic lights. But crime doesn't always come dressed in ski masks and ski mobiles. Sometimes, it shows up in matching school uniforms, smiling for the camera. I pulled into the neighborhood on a hot Thursday. The house still stood, faded siding, sun-warped shingles. There was a for sale by owner sign in the yard. The kind that says, no one wants to answer questions. But I had keys. The real estate agent, an old contact from a foreclosure story, owed me a favor. She warned me before handing them over. Don't linger. That place, it holds on to things. The inside was cold despite the heat outside. I don't mean air conditioned. I mean cold like a church basement or an abandoned piano studio, where things were once meant to sing but silence took over. Then I saw it. The bone white. Still stained faintly. I stepped closer, recorder in one hand, heart thudding like a news deadline. I could feel it, that moment. The moment Nikki might have screamed or begged or simply went quiet. I saw the vase, the shards, the knife. The towel rack she tried to grab. I closed my eyes and the house whispered. They didn't leave her alone. They stayed until the end. That night, I checked into a motel on the edge of Conyers. Keep. Orange lighting. A bedspread that smelled like bleach and secrets. I spread out the old police files on the comforter like sacred text. Crime scene photos. Interview transcripts. The original arrest affidavit. And tucked into the back of the folder, I found something new. A page no one had cited in court. A flagged transaction log from a shell bank in the Cayman Islands. Two wire transfers in Nikki Whitehead's name. One a week before the murder. One the day after. Both empty now. But once active. That was the moment everything shifted. Because Nikki wasn't rich. She worked in beauty salons. Drove an old car. fought for her girls in family court like a woman drowning in legal fees. So why did she have an offshore account? And why was no one talking about it? This wasn't just about rage or revenge or a fight gone wrong. This was a true crime story with financial crimes buried under red tape and silence. And if that email was right, it had been carefully curated to look simple. The next morning, I drove to the jail. The Rockdale Youth Detention Center, where the twins had first been held before sentencing, sat on the edge of farmland like a forgotten concrete box. I stared through the gate and wondered which window had once belonged to Jasmia. Which one to Tasmia. Whether they ever watched the rainfall and thought about the blood. The court footage told one story. Emotional confessions, sudden outbursts, synchronized apologies. But the early police interrogations told another. When I played them back, something always caught my breath. The sister's language. The rehearsed grief. The pauses, too long. The confusion, too short. Like actors stumbling off script. And always, always that flicker in their eyes when the detective mentioned their mother. Not guilt. Not fear. Relief. By the end of that week, I was drowning in timelines and contradictions. Nikki had filed a protective order just 10 days before her death. She told family members she felt unsafe. She begged the judge not to send the girls back to her. But Child Services, lost in a fog of bureaucracy, closed the case with a shrug. And so they came home. And 4 days later, she died. Perfection in detailing, I remember writing in my notes. The crime scene was chaotic, yes. But the story afterward, clean. Linear. Almost too clean. And then I found it. Buried in the back of an evidence locker. A school notebook with poetry by Tasmia. Doodles. Skulls. And one line scribbled in red pen again and again like a prayer or a spell. Freedom is only found in silence. And silence comes in red. I ended that first leg of my journey sitting in the motel parking lot, watching the sky fade into gray. I hit record on my mic. They said this was a simple case. A mother. Two daughters. A fatal argument. But stories like these, they're never simple. They are layers. They are ghosts. They are daughters born in rage or shaped by it. They are mothers screaming from basements no one investigates. And they are unsettling narratives that demand we look harder and ask who we're willing to believe. Then I stopped the recording. Because the next voice I needed wasn't mine. It was someone who'd lived it. And someone somewhere still had Nikki's other phone. It took me 3 weeks to find Nikki Whitehead's second phone. And it wasn't in evidence. Not in the official crime scene inventory. Not in the police transcript. Not in the trial exhibits that were paraded in front of jurors to prove this was a case of adolescent rage. But I found it. Wedged inside a box of old hair products at a storage unit in Lithonia, 22 minutes from the house where Nikki died. The unit was under her ex-boyfriend's name, a man who vanished the same week she did. No autopsy could explain that kind of coincidence. The keypad was dead, the battery swollen. But the SIM card was intact. I held it in my hand, knowing what I was about to do might cross a line. Then again, this whole story had been one long stumble across moral boundaries. If this was just a mother-daughter domestic tragedy, why was there a secret phone locked away in a paid rental unit tied to a man whose financial trail led straight to offshore accounts? You don't hide a phone unless you're hiding a truth. I powered it up in a data recovery lab in Atlanta. One of those backdoor IT places where hackers moonlight as saints. He charged me $700. But what I got in return was priceless. 152 text messages, 23 voicemails, and 7 deleted videos. Some were typical. Flirtations. Salon appointments. Notes from friends about court dates and school pickups. But others? Others bled into the chilling narrative I hadn't yet fully realized I was part of. He said if I go to court, he'll make everything disappear. I think they know. I think Jazz read my journal. If something happens to me, check under the floorboard. I read them all twice. The third time I pressed record. This isn't just a murder tale. I said softly into the mic. This is an investigation narrative with a heartbeat. And it's still pounding. The next morning, I returned to Conyers. This time not to chase a headline. I was hunting silence. The girl's juvenile hearing had been sealed, standard practice in Georgia for minors. But Nikki had filed at least 4 formal complaints in family court during the months leading to her death. I knew if I could find those, I might map the rage that had built into a killing. or at least understand how a mother could fear her own children and still be ordered by the state to tuck them in at night. At the Rockdale County Clerk's office, the woman behind the window looked at me the way Southern bureaucrats always do, with suspicion and the slow, smug power of red tape. She typed into her ancient Dell monitor, clicked her tongue, and slid a form back to me without a word. "Records are sealed," she finally said. "You'd need a judge's order." "What about the notes Nikki filed with Child Services?" I asked. "Destroyed after the trial," she replied too quickly. "Standard purge. Nothing left to access. Nothing left to access." It echoed like a scream from a locked door. Outside, I sat in my car and stared at the courthouse steps, thinking about Nikki's last days. How many times she must have climbed those stairs with documents in hand, hope clutched like a shield, only to be dismissed by a system more interested in procedure than protection. The shadows of justice don't always fall on the guilty. Sometimes they swallow the ones crying for help. That night, I listened to the first voicemail on Nikki's phone. Her voice was urgent. Frantic. "You don't understand," she whispered. "They watch me. They listen. I sleep with one eye open. I'm not just scared of them. I'm scared of who they're becoming. You ever seen your daughter smile after hurting you?" Dead air. The timestamp was 3 days before the murder. She had known. She had begged. And no one listened. I started seeing them everywhere, the twins. In the symmetry of buildings. In a pair of church windows across from the motel. In my dreams. Standing in the hallway of that house, eyes wide, breath shallow, blood on their shoes and silence on their lips. Were they victims? Monsters? Mirrors of a mother who made mistakes? Or were they the product of a deeper machinery, raised in a home of instability, tossed between caretakers told they were loved, then left to rage in the margins? I made a list on the motel wall. Names. Connections. Fragments. Like a crime scene web. Nikki Whitehead. Mother. Victim. Jasmia and Tasmia. Daughters. Convicted. Della Frazier. Great-grandmother. Custody battle. Errol Red Thompson, ex-boyfriend. Disappeared. $14,900 wire transfer. Cayman Bank account closed. Missing journal. Last seen 2 days before Nikki's death. At the center of it all was a note I kept circling. Check under the floorboard. I had to go back to the house. The next day I broke in. The real estate agent hadn't returned my calls. And the new lock was cheap. I waited until dusk. Slipped inside. Moved quietly past the yellowing walls. The tub sat still and cold just as I left it. But I wasn't there for that. I was there for the hallway closet. The floor creaked when I stepped in. I lifted the old plank. Dust. Dead bugs. Then a small mold dark box. Inside it, three things. A cracked journal. A flash drive. And a piece of cloth, pink, soaked with what looked like dried blood. I froze. The journal was Nikki's. I recognized her handwriting from old forms. Pages torn. Some soaked. But one entry was still clear, written in angry loops. If I end up dead, they'll say it was a fight. They'll say I provoked it. But they don't know. They don't see what I see. They don't sleep where I sleep. I sat on the floor and cried. Not because I was afraid. But because I realized then that this story wasn't just about Nikki. It was hers. And no one had told it yet. I didn't sleep the night I found the journal. I laid it across the motel desk, the pages bowed from years of damp. Her handwriting felt like a voice from the grave, angry, rushed, terrified. Like she wrote each word knowing no one would ever believe her. Or worse, that they'd believe her too late. But the flash drive, that was something else. I plugged it into my encrypted field laptop, hands shaking. For a second, nothing happened. Then a folder, untitled. Hidden beneath layers of blank documents. Inside were 11 video files and 2 PDFs. The first video opened to darkness. Then Nikki's voice, "This is for whoever finds it. If something happens to me, don't stop at the girls." My breath caught. She was sitting on her bed, phone camera propped up. Her face was bruised, lightly but unmistakably. A shadow moved in the background. She flinched but kept filming. "They think I don't know," she said. "But I've seen the messages. I've seen the photos. He got in their heads. Turned them against me. Promised them freedom if I disappeared." She never said his name. But I knew who she meant. Errol Red Thompson. I'd seen his name buried in a few old records. Never cited, never accused, just there. A man from Nikki's past. Sometimes a boyfriend. Sometimes a threat. Described by neighbors as controlling, flashy, and slick as oil. He ran a now-defunct salon business that shared an address with a piano studio Nikki once claimed she was opening. A studio no one remembered visiting. On paper, the two ventures had no connection. But the PDF files on the flash drive told a different story. One was a lease agreement for a commercial unit. Signed by Nikki. Co-signed by Errol. The other was a receipt of a bank transfer for $14,900. Recipient, Redseo. Origin, offshore, Cayman Securities LTD. Date, January 11, 2010. 2 days before Nikki's death. That was no coincidence. This wasn't just a story of teenage rage anymore. This was a financial scam. A slow burn manipulation. A man who knew how to move money, how to exploit family chaos, and how to disappear beneath the weight of someone else's crime. Justice tales always ask for a villain. But what if the villain never steps into the light? I tracked Red's last known address to a two-story rental in Riverdale. Peeling paint, satellite dish rusted into the side. The mailbox still had his name. Inside the building, no one answered. But the landlord told me something curious. He paid the rent 6 months in advance, she said. Then ghosted. I figured he hit a big case or something. She meant big case like a lawsuit. I meant big case like a homicide. That night, I watched all 11 videos. They were raw like surveillance diaries. Nikki filming herself in silence. Sometimes bruised. Sometimes crying. Sometimes staring into the camera like it owed her answers. In one, she whispered, I tried to get help. Della won't listen. The court won't listen. The girls think he's the answer to everything. I'm the problem in their eyes. But he's feeding that fire. That was the line that stayed with me. Because when the girls confessed, when they finally cracked under the weight of a police interrogation they thought they could outwit, they never mentioned Red. Not once. Not even when prompted. That kind of omission isn't accidental. That's training. That's someone cleaning the narrative. That's a hidden killer. I booked an interview with Della Frazier the next morning. She looked tired. Older. The weight of years had sunk into her shoulders. She'd buried a daughter and surrendered two granddaughters to the state. Grief like that ages you from the inside. I don't want to talk about the murder, she said. I'm not here to talk about the murder, I lied. But I eased her in. Let her vent. Let her talk about the girls. About how sweet they once were. How Nikki got involved with the wrong people and should have known better. And then, she slipped. Red was always hanging around, she muttered. Smooth talker. Drove a Lexus. Bought the girls' iPods one Christmas like he was Santa Claus. Do you think he manipulated them? I asked. She paused. Blinked slowly. Then gave me a look that I can only describe as haunted. I think the devil wears good cologne, she said. And when you're a child with broken pieces, even the devil feels like a father. I left her porch in silence. Some quotes don't need editing. Later that night, I called in a favor, an old contact at the GBI who owed me a leak. When I asked him about Errol Thompson, he was quiet. You didn't hear it from me, he said, but there was a sealed file on him connected to two other murder narratives. Never enough to stick. Always just outside the circle. Was he questioned in Nikki Whitehead's murder? Briefly. Alibi was loose. But once the girls confessed, nobody pushed it. Why? Because the state needed a conviction. They had two. It was neat. It was clean. Perfection in detailing. Nobody wanted to muddy it up. So they didn't. They left the mud for me. Back in my motel, I added new names to the list on my wall. Red Thompson, manipulator. Possibly mastermind. Red CO. Fraud front? Shell company? Judge Barrow. Signed the custody transfer 4 days before the murder. Cayman Securities. Still under GBI investigation. The puzzle wasn't just coming together. It was bleeding together. This wasn't just one of those true crime stories you tell at parties. It was a sinister case about influence, power, and the silent puppeteers who manipulate rage for their own gain. And the scariest part? The girls never stood a chance. They used to smile the same. That's the thing people forget about the Whitehead twins. Before the blood, before the headlines, before the screaming on YouTube comment sections, Jasmia and Tasmia could smile in perfect unison. A mirror with two faces. But time breaks symmetry. And prison makes a crack permanent. It took me 7 months of paperwork, manipulation, and whispered favors to get a face-to-face interview with one of them. The request was broad. Interview for a podcast covering female incarceration. I didn't say which story. I didn't have to. Because when the approval came through, it was only for Tasmia. The one people called the softer twin. The one who always broke first. I met her at Arundale State Prison in Alto, Georgia. Concrete towers. Razor wire wrapped around the perimeter like a crown of thorns. They brought her in wearing beige. No cuffs. Her hands rested gently in her lap. Her face was thinner than in the trial footage. Older. Hollowed by time. But her eyes still held something sharp. A sharp mind dulled by circumstance. She sat across from me, arms folded, lips pursed. "You're not the first one to ask about it," she said flatly. "But you're the first to say my mother's name with respect." I turned on my recorder. "What changed that day?" I asked her. "Everything," she said. "And nothing." She paused. Then, almost as if a weight slipped off her ribs. "We weren't monsters. But we weren't innocent either. And he knew that. He watched it all." "Who's he?" I asked, knowing the answer. "Red. Whatever name he's using now." Her voice cracked just a little. I let her speak uninterrupted. She told me about the gifts, the late-night texts, the way Red made them feel like they mattered. How he always framed Nikki as the villain. "She's keeping you down. She's jealous of you. She wants you to be like her. Classic financial grooming. Not for love. For leverage." "We didn't want to kill her," Tasmia said. "But we didn't stop ourselves either." There was silence then. The kind of silence that lives in old courtrooms and confessionals. Then I asked her something no one else had. "Was someone else there that day?" Her lips twitched. Just a flicker. Her eyes darted sideways. Then back. "We didn't plan it," she whispered. "But someone did." "Did Red show up?" Another pause. This one was too long. And when she finally answered, it wasn't with words. It was with tears. After the interview, the prison warden gave me an envelope. "She said you'd know what to do with it," he muttered. Inside was a folded sheet of notebook paper, torn at the edges. Written in faint blue ink, it read, "Basement. Wall behind the washer. There's a camera. He installed it." My blood ran cold. That house had already given me Nikki's journal. The flash drive. The floorboard secrets. But now I was being told that something else had been there all along. Watching. Recording. Witnessing. A crime scene investigation overlooked it. A trial ignored it. But maybe the truth hadn't. I broke into the house for the second time that month. It was easier this time. Too easy. The place was unsold. So, maybe it was cursed. Or maybe the neighbors knew something they didn't want to explain. Down in the basement, I found the washer. It was old, rusted, the kind with a steel drum that clanged like a coffin when you moved it. Behind it, a panel. And behind that panel, just as she said, was a tiny lens-covered device. Now corroded by time but unmistakably a camera. There had been surveillance. Someone had watched the murder unfold. And that someone had never said a word. I brought the camera to my hacker contact in Atlanta. He called me 2 days later, his voice tighter than usual. "I couldn't recover video," he said. But the memory card wasn't blank. It had one file. Dated the morning of the murder. "You need to see this." I drove to his shop. No lights. Just a monitor screen playing a muted video. It showed a corner of the kitchen, Nikki's back to the lens. A shadow moves behind her. Then two more. And then four. The figure was taller. Male. Unmistakable. Errol Red Thompson. He was in the house. He watched it happen. Maybe he even triggered it. I felt sick. Because this wasn't just another murder narrative. This was a carefully curated crime story. Designed to protect the real puppet master while leaving two damaged girls to burn in his place. A hidden killer not legally named. Not pursued. Because he vanished. Because he was useful to someone. Because the courts needed it clean. That night, I opened Nikki's journal one more time. Near the back was a torn-out page that had stuck to another. I hadn't noticed it before. In big, frantic lettering, she'd scrawled, "They think killing me will free them. But he'll still own their silence. If you're reading this, tell the story." I whispered aloud, I will. And I meant it. Because this was the moment the whole case fractured. The neat conviction. The courtroom smiles. The forensic timelines. All of it, unraveled. The girls weren't innocent. But they weren't the only guilty ones either. The first message came 3 days after I found the camera. No return address. No name. Just a manila envelope slid under the motel door while I was at dinner. Inside was a single sheet of printer paper, blank except for one line in bold block font. Stop digging, or we'll bury what's left of her story. No signature. No fingerprints. No trace. I stared at it for a long time. The message wasn't a warning. It was a promise. And whoever sent it didn't just know I was investigating. They knew exactly what I'd uncovered. Someone was watching me now. Just like they watched Nikki. And for the first time since this started, I felt fear curl at the base of my spine. I didn't sleep that night. Instead, I turned back to the financial crimes. The money trail that had always felt like background noise was now screaming in my ears. The PDF on Nikki's flash drive. The $14,900 wire transfer from Cayman Securities Limited. Listed a client number. C7789GT. I cross-referenced it through a shadow data leak I'd used before. What came up wasn't a name. It was a cluster. At least four separate accounts all tied to Red CO. All moving money through layered wealth shielding techniques. Shell companies stacked like Russian dolls, layered through Florida, then Belize, then the Caymans. Every account linked by one IP address in Decatur, Georgia. I wrote one word across my notebook in red pen. Untraceable doesn't mean invisible. The next lead came from a murder I'd covered 5 years earlier. Her name was Vanessa Hill, a 42-year-old single mother found dead in her rental home in McDonough, Georgia. The cause of death, blunt force trauma. Her teenage son had been arrested and convicted. Claimed they got into a fight over school. Claimed he blacked out. The twist. Vanessa had once dated Errol Thompson. And just like Nikki, she'd recently been awarded full custody. The deeper I looked, the more familiar the details became. Abuse allegations, sudden financial accounts opened in her name, an anonymous tip to child services warning she was unstable. All the same patterns. Two mothers. Two dead. Two teenagers left to take the fall. And one ghost moving in the shadows behind them. This wasn't coincidence. This was a method. A chilling narrative disguised as domestic dysfunction. By now my inbox was poisoned. Fake names. Encrypted threats. Even a message from someone claiming to be a justice broker. Whatever the hell that meant, telling me I was trespassing on protected history. But buried inside the noise came one message that caught my breath. A Proton Mail account, no reply to address. Subject. Carver's Estate. You missed something. Attached was a .jpg image. Grainy. Surveillance style. It showed a house I recognized instantly. Nikki's childhood home. But that wasn't what made my stomach drop. It was what the camera had captured at the far right edge of the frame. Red. Standing in the yard. Watching. Smiling. The timestamp was dated March 4, 2025. 2 weeks ago. He was still alive. He was back. I drove straight to Carver's estate that afternoon. It's a broken cul-de-sac now. Half the houses boarded up, the others crumbling beneath southern sun and mildew. Nikki's childhood house was locked, but not fortified. I slid through a warped back window and walked through rooms that smelled of rot and old memories. There, taped behind a kitchen cabinet, I found what I hadn't known I was looking for. A folder marked Depositions, Barrow Case. Barrow. Judge Barrow. The same judge who sent the girls back to Nikki 4 days before she died. Inside the folder were typed statements, dated years ago. One name kept repeating. Errol T. Personal advisor, family consultant, intervention witness. Errol had been in the courtroom. Not once. Multiple times. As a witness for custody. As a friend of the court. Red tape had given him legitimacy. The bureaucracy had handed him power. This wasn't just manipulation. It was systemic infiltration. And if he'd done it once, he'd done it before. I returned to my motel with shaking hands. I knew I was in danger. I knew the shadows of justice had reached past one family and infected the very systems that claimed to protect them. And I knew I was next. So I hit record. This is the moment every investigative journalist has nightmares about, I whispered. When the story stops being about them and becomes about you. When the story unveils not just corruption but complicity. When the killer isn't hiding in a basement. He's sitting in a courtroom. He's whispering into the ears of judges. He's building his shield with bureaucracy, hiding inside carefully curated paperwork, and using children as pawns. I stopped recording. My laptop pinged. A new message. Just four words. You're almost there. Stop. I didn't. I met her in a church parking lot just off I-20. She had emailed me from a burner account with the subject line, "They paid us in silence." I kept a copy. No name. No greeting. Just a GPS pin, a time, and the initials. KM. I sat in my rental car, sweat gathering at my spine, wondering if I was about to meet a source. Or a setup. Then she arrived. Black SUV. Tinted windows. She stepped out slow. Cautious but purposeful. Mid-50s brown suit, no makeup. She moved like someone who'd spent her life in the shadows of power and knew exactly how fragile that power was. Karen Mitchell, she said flatly, handing me a sealed manila envelope. Rockdale County. Court clerk. Retired. Or, retired early after I found out what the judge was signing without oversight. She lit a cigarette with a trembling hand. And that's when she told me everything. According to Karen, Judge Joseph Barrow had presided over 12 juvenile custody transfers in a 5-year span, all with sealed records, all involving high-conflict households, and all connected, either directly or through second-degree associates, to a man named Errol Red Thompson. I was the only clerk who questioned it, she said. I told the judge I couldn't find CPS reports in 3 of the cases. He told me, quote, "Don't worry about the noise. Just move the paper." Red tape soaked in blood. Karen wasn't just talking about oversight. She was talking about complicity. Barrow had issued the final ruling to return Jasmia and Tasmia to Nikki Whitehead's custody, despite open case files with child services and despite Nikki's desperate plea, filed in her own handwriting, warning, "I fear for my life. I'm not safe. They need intervention, not reintegration." That plea was never entered into the record. Barrow sealed it, as someone told him to. Inside the envelope Karen gave me was a USB drive. On it, 6 deposition transcripts, 3 internal memos, and 1 audio file that shook me more than anything I'd heard since this story began. It was a voicemail from Barrow's private line, dated a week after Nikki's murder. He was speaking to someone, possibly Errol, though the name was redacted. The twins gave us everything we needed. Clean plea. No messy trial. Tell your guy we're square. I played it back 10 times. Then once more, just to hear the way his voice smiled through the phone. This wasn't a rogue judge. This was infrastructure. A chilling secret buried inside the very courtroom built to deliver justice. That night, I booked a new motel. Paid cash. No phone calls. No social media. I started having dreams where Nikki stood at the foot of my bed. She didn't speak. She just pointed to something behind me. When I woke, the motel power was out. There was a knock at the door. I didn't answer. I waited. Then another knock. When I finally opened the door, heart racing, recorder in my hand, there was no one. Just a single item left on the ground. A child's ribbon. Pink. Stained at the tip. The next morning, I called in a final favor. An old journalist friend, once a data analyst, now a digital ghost, agreed to trace the flow of Red CO's accounts. He came back with one line. "You're not dealing with a man. You're dealing with a system. Red CO is a laundry cycle. Drug fronts. Fraud charities. Even one under the banner of a piano education grant. A piano studio. Just like Nikki mentioned. Just like the studio that never opened. The nonprofit was registered through a church in Macon, Georgia. Its listed donor? Barrow Family Trust." At this point, the pieces no longer needed stitching. They were blood-soaked and screaming. Errol wasn't just manipulating broken homes. He was curating crime scenes, engineering chaos, leveraging the system, and ensuring the fall always landed on someone else. Teenagers. Women. Broken men with nothing to lose. It was investigative storytelling turned inside out. A predator who knew exactly how far the system's gaze could stretch, and how to dance just outside its reach. He wasn't hiding in shadows. He was the shadow. I drafted a report. 20 pages. names files audio. I sent it to two outlets I trusted. No response. Then I got the second threat. Another envelope. Inside, a single photograph of my younger brother, walking out of his college dorm. On the back it read, "Everyone has a bathtub. Don't step into yours." That night, I recorded what might have been my last log. They told me this was a story about twins. About teenage rage. But what they really gave me was a doorway into southern darkness. A tale of financial corruption, hidden killers, and justice stories rewritten to protect predators with perfect teeth. Nikki tried to scream. No one listened. I did. And if I vanish tomorrow, someone somewhere will still find this file. And know the truth. I didn't hit publish. Not yet. Because I still had one place left to go. And if what Karen said was true, if the man behind all of this still lived in Georgia, then I was going to find him. He was hiding in plain sight. After everything, after the blood, the sealed court files, the offshore accounts, the bathtub and the basement, Errol Red Thompson hadn't fled the country. He hadn't changed his name. He hadn't been dragged before a judge or even questioned on the record. He just moved six towns over. A small farmhouse in Putnam County. 40 minutes southeast of Conyers. Hidden at the end of a gravel road behind a curtain of pine trees. Property owned by a shell company called Clearwater Equity, another arm of the Red CO. Hydra. The address was in one of Karen's leaked memos. I traced it through a dummy real estate trust and cross-checked it with a voter registration form filed in 2023. That's how I found him. Still breathing. Still living. And somehow still untouched. I didn't go in with a camera. I didn't go in with a recorder. I went in with nothing but my voice, and a question that had burned through my ribcage since the first time I saw Nikki's autopsy photo. Why did you choose them? I parked my rental 200 yards away and walked the rest. The air was thick with silence and sawdust. A wind chime clinked lazily on the porch. The place was too calm for what I knew had happened in his orbit. I knocked once. He answered on the second. And when he saw me, he smiled. That same slick, camera-ready grin I'd seen in old license photos and video stills. He looked older now. Grayer around the temples. But his eyes were sharp. Confident. Like he already knew I wouldn't be leaving with what I wanted. "Miss Reporter," he said as if we were old friends. "You finally made it. You knew I'd come?" He laughed, warm like syrup. "Everyone chases the devil eventually. What matters is whether they survive the conversation." I stepped inside. The place was clean. Farton. Too clean. Like it was staged. A single coffee table. An empty bookshelf. And on the wall, a framed photo of the piano studio that never opened. I pointed to it. "Nikki's dream. My investment," he said. "She had vision. I just gave her a stage." I nearly choked. The audacity. The performance. For 30 minutes we played chess with our words. He admitted nothing. But he denied nothing either. When I asked about Vanessa Hill, he said, "Poor woman. Mental health's a tragedy." When I brought up the offshore wire transfers, he said, "It's a global economy. You think those politicians don't do the same?" When I finally said Nikki's name, he tilted his head and smiled, just barely. "You think I killed her? I think you orchestrated the fall." And yet, the twins confessed. "After you rewrote the narrative. After you poisoned them. I offered them freedom. You sold them slavery." The room pulsed with silence. Then he stood. "If you're waiting for a confession," he said, "you won't get one. That's not how the shadows work. We don't confess. We outlast." He walked to a cabinet, opened it, and pulled out a manila folder. Dropped it at my feet. "You want to tell the story?" he said. "Here. Finish it." Inside. Copies of sealed court rulings. Checks made out to Barrow. Donation ledgers from the piano studio grant fund tied to three other counties. Receipts. Names. A map of corruption so vast it made my hands go numb. "Why are you giving me this?" I asked. He leaned in close. "Because it doesn't matter anymore. By the time you make sense of it, by the time you publish, the system will have replaced every player. Barrow's already gone. Karen. You think she's still breathing? She gave you that file, didn't she?" My breath stopped. "You're lying. Check your inbox." When I left, I didn't speak. Didn't think. I drove 6 hours straight, hands locked at 10 and 2. Only when I reached a hotel outside Savannah did I open my email. At the top of my inbox, breaking: retired Rockdale court clerk found dead of apparent overdose. Karen Mitchell, 57, was found unresponsive in her home early Tuesday morning. Authorities ruled the death non-suspicious. No foul play is suspected. No foul play. Just a body in the wake of a secret too loud to live. I hit record. My voice shook. This isn't just a story anymore. It's a pattern. A crime architecture built from red tape, sealed folders, and broken girls. Nikki was a target. So was Vanessa. And now Karen. Every time a woman tried to break the cycle, she disappeared. And the twins? They weren't killers. They were weapons. Manufactured. Molded. Released. Then punished. All while the puppeteer smiled from a porch with no blood on his hands. I slept with a chair against the hotel door that night. I dreamed of Nikki again. This time she was holding a tape recorder. He pressed play and I heard my own voice. Reading her journal. Telling her story. And behind her, two shadows sat in the corner. Girls. So. Silent. Waiting for someone to believe them. I was out of options. I couldn't trust the courts. The press was silent. The inboxes of every major podcast network remained unopened. My confidential submissions were either rejected or ghosted completely. I had a folder that could crack open a Southern crime ring spanning two decades, and no one wanted it. It wasn't just too dangerous. It was too real. Because this wasn't the kind of true crime story the public liked. It wasn't clean. It wasn't over. And it didn't fit in a docuseries with moody piano music and reenacted confessionals. It was about children turned weapons, mothers erased, and institutions that smiled while it happened. I had one move left. I'd burn the whole thing down with truth. I booked a podcast studio in Atlanta under a fake name. Small. Independent. An old sound engineer I trusted owed me a favor. He didn't ask questions, just handed me the key, queued up the mic, and left. I locked the door behind me, pulled out Nikki's journal, Karen's files, the red CO, receipts, the judge's voice memo, the flash drive, the ribbon, and my own recordings. I spread them out on the desk like a war map. And I began. My name doesn't matter, I said. What matters is this. Everything you were told about the Whitehead twins was a lie. And I told it all. From the screams in the basement to the piano studio scam. From the missing phone to the manipulated daughters. From Judge Barrow to Errol Thompson's godlike grip on a justice system built to ignore black women like Nikki Whitehead. I told them about the financial crimes, the offshore accounts, the sewn shut red tape. I told them about Karen Mitchell's overdose. I told them that the girls had confessed, but to a story someone else wrote for them. I told them that Nikki predicted her own murder, and her warnings were sealed away like a dirty family secret. This is not entertainment, I whispered into the mic. This is not a genre. This is not a docuseries. This is not just another Southern crime. This is what happens when the system trains its shadows to protect monsters and punishes the broken for breaking. And then I said her name one last time. Jarmeca Whitehead. Nikki. Mother. Victim. Fighter. They called you loud. Difficult. Erratic. But I heard you. And now so will the world. I uploaded the full 82-minute file to four platforms simultaneously. YouTube, Spotify, Spreaker, and a dark web archive hosted by journalists in exile. I encrypted copies, uploaded mirrors, and scheduled them to publish if I went offline for more than 24 hours. By morning it was viral. The title, Shadows of Justice, The Story They Tried to Bury. Downloads in the tens of thousands, then hundreds. Reddit lit up. TikTok exploded. Hashtag Nikki was right. Hashtag twins were used. Hashtag Shadows of Justice. And then, the blowback. I was doxxed within 48 hours. My name. My photo. My old apartment address. My editor texted me once, "Whatever you've done, lawyers are circling." 2 days later, I received a formal cease and desist from a law firm representing Clearwater Equity. Defamation. Speculation. Libel. Dangerous narrative warfare. But the story was out. And for once, the court of public opinion screamed louder than the courtroom itself. A week later, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation announced a reopening of the Whitehead case. Then came the real crack. A whistleblower inside the IRS leaked tax records linking Red CO to over $2 million in unreported religious grant money routed through Judge Barrow's estate, the same estate that had mysteriously donated to over 18 custody cases, all involving vulnerable mothers and fatherless teens. The same structure used in Vanessa Hill's case. The same structure used in Nikki Whitehead's. And then the press finally followed. CBS, NPR, The New York Times. They quoted my podcast directly. They called it a landmark exposure in the new era of grassroots investigative journalism. But I didn't celebrate, because Nikki was still dead. Vanessa was still gone. Karen was buried. And the twins, still locked in cages built from a system they never designed. I filed an official petition to the Georgia Innocence Project, concluded. New evidence from the camera footage. Rhett's voice on Barrow's line. Karen's documents. Psychological assessments from two forensic experts. Nikki's own words recovered from the journal and flash drive. 3 months later, the case was accepted for review. Tasmia agreed to a follow-up interview. Jasmia declined. But both, now nearing 32, had one request. Tell it right. Don't make it a headline. Make it a warning. I still sleep with my phone off. Still watch my rearview mirror longer than I should. But the story is alive. And Nikki's voice, once ignored, once erased, now echoes through earbuds across the world. I still play that voicemail sometimes. The one where she said, if something happens to me, check under the floorboard. I did. No. So have you.